Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. In section 4 of his essay, The Will to Believe, William James will set out what he calls, by the title of that section, the thesis of the essay. And it runs like this. He says, our passional nature not only lawfully may, but must decide an option between propositions whenever it is a genuine option that cannot by its nature be decided on intellectual grounds. So what are we talking about there? He's saying that when we don't have intellectual grounds for deciding certain sorts of options, that is genuine options, as he's defined them a little bit earlier in the work, then our passional nature is not only permitted to help us make that decision, we have to make that decision along passional lines. And we'll come back to that in a moment, because you might say, okay, well, what does that actually mean, this passional, or he's going to call it also volitional or willing nature? You could also talk about this in terms of affectivity and its connection with belief. So if we jump back further to the beginning of the previous section, he talks about this guy, William Clifford. And William Clifford is in his famous essay as well, saying that we should never believe anything unless we have evidence for it. And James says that's kind of a weird position to take, because we do that all the time, especially even scientists and the people who are supposed to be the most rational. And even you, as he's going to say a little bit later in it, even you, William Clifford, believe things without necessarily having, you know, perfect reasons for doing so. Now, there is some truth to this. He says that it is only our already dead hypotheses that our willing nature is unable to bring to life again. But what has made them dead for us is, for the most part, a previous action of our willing nature of an antagonistic kind. That is, we have decided, no, that's not true. And, you know, so for example, the person who has left a group who they belong to and can no longer buy into their lies and charlatanry or whatever else it's going to be, their ideology, their brainwashing, right? They've actually decided on some level that they're not going to believe what that group has to say. And sometimes they can swing to another extreme where they'll disbelieve any true facts that that group brings forward. So he says, what is this willing nature? What does this comprise? And again, here we could talk about affectivity or all sorts of other things as well. James here, and it's good to remember too, James is not only a philosopher, but also a psychologist, so he's got a lot fuller treatments of this elsewhere. But here in this essay, he distinguishes two things. He says that the willing nature includes what he calls deliberate volitions, as may have set up habits of belief that we cannot now escape from. So deliberate volitions, those are actually sort of a small subset of volitions where we sat down and we weighed evidence, or, you know, decided what's the most prudent thing to do, and we made a decision. And then because of that, those set up habits of belief. So generally this involves doing it more than once. So the habits of belief now we cannot escape from, at least at this point in time. We're sort of stuck with them. And we could think about this in terms of training, we could think about this in terms of education, we could think about this in terms of deprogramming and reprogramming and all of those sorts of fairly deliberate, at least mostly conscious activities where we say, yes, I'm going to see things this way. No, I'm not going to see things this way anymore. But it includes a lot more than that in this willing nature. He says it includes all factors of belief. And here James gives us a non-exhaustive list, largely organized, I would say, along rhetorical lines. This was, in fact, a public address, so this is not the comprehensive list of all the possible factors of belief. He's just giving us some important examples here. He says, fear and hope. We could think of those as fundamental types of affectivities, right? Typically, we would contrast, say, hope and despair, but despair is sort of fear intensified. Desire, we might also place under hope. And we could think of other emotions that play a role in there as well. Anger is a prime example. Joy, sadness, excitement, boredom, all of those could play a role within whether or not we believe things. Prejudice and passion. Right? There are many things on which we have prejudices, and he's going to give some examples. Let's take a look at some of the examples that he brings up, because some of them may not be all that effective for us. He says, here in this room, we all believe in molecules and the conservation of energy. I think most of us probably believe in that. In democracy and necessary progress. Democracy, I think most of us are for that, although we may not like the way democracy works in many places. Necessary progress, now we're getting a little bit more sketchy. In Protestant Christianity and the duty of fighting for the doctrine of the immortal Monroe, I think we can probably say that that one, for most of us, is definitely not among our prejudices. The doctrine of the immortal Monroe was the Monroe Doctrine, which said that the United States would not allow foreign intervention within Central or South America, with the idea being that eventually the United States would incorporate all of that within their sphere of influence. I don't know that too many people, even here in America, buy into that anymore as a prejudice. But we can say we have other prejudices instead. The incredible amount of difficulties that we're winding up in providing something that most developed countries have had for quite a while, say universal health care, and the quandaries that people are finding themselves in because they can't wrap their head around the government actually being able to do that when it's done so routinely in so many other places. That's a prejudice, essentially, right? We could talk about other prejudices of the Americas, but we can talk about prejudices of other places as well. Prejudices and passions, right? Imitation and partisanship. There's many things that we learn just by imitating other people doing them. There's a great old joke about the line forming, and somebody gets in the line and they ask the person ahead of them, hey, what's this line for? And the other person says, I don't know, but I saw that there was a line, so I figured it must be something important. So I lined up, and it goes all the way up to the front of the line, and nobody knows what the hell they're in line for. Well, that's imitation taken to the extreme, is it not? But, some of it could be what Rene Girard has called mimetic desire. The release of the new iPhone matters because other people think it matters. And so now you get infected with that feeling and you think, I'd better get there in line, right? Partisanship can play a major role. We see this in our divided electorate today, where people have taken it so far as to say that they won't even consider dating, and they're in some cases talking with somebody from the other side, and they are extremely gullible when it comes to their favored news sources. Circumpressure of our caste and set. That's an interesting idea. He's talking about background there, our class background, right? Where we fit in society. A good example of this is you think about people and their mindsets that are produced by how they grow up, what options they see as possible for them that actually makes sense. Those are live options, and what are dead are set, the people that we spend time with. And so, he's got quite a few good examples of that, but I think we could think of our own. All of this is our willing nature. Each of us carries around an entire set of constellations of affective points that we bear with us from situation to situation, adding a little bit, taking some away, modifying a bit here and there, but never changing it all at the same time, except through catastrophic and traumatic experiences, which even then are interpreted in light of what we bring to it. Now, he says that these passional tendencies and volitions, a little bit down before that, he says, our non-intellectual nature does influence our convictions. There are passional tendencies and volitions, some of which run before and others which come after belief. And he says, it's only the latter, those who come after, that are too late for the fair, and they're not too late when the previous passional work has already been going in their direction. So even then, they can be incorporated into the mix. He also talks about this tendency on most people's part, including, he admits, his own, for one's own reason, especially among, we probably should say, the people who are the biggest advocates and shouters about reason, logic, facts, all that sort of stuff. They're typically satisfied with just a few arguments that go in their favor. They often ignore the ones that don't. And they also, we should point out here, tend to ignore the fact that things like reason, logic, science, rationality, these are equivocal terms that require a lot of clarification. So, you know, most people tend to be happy with being provided a few arguments so it doesn't shake their intellectual boat, to mix metaphors a little bit. And there's this wonderful phrase that he has here, faith in other people's faith. The idea that somebody else found this convincing is often enough to produce a belief on another person's part. I'll admit that works for me as well. You know, I have a limited time to read authors, and when I look at who I should spend the time to read, I often will see what the people who I respect have to say about that author. Is it worth checking them out? And I also look to see the people who I think are jerks or stupid, what they say about that author. If they're blowing them up and everyone's like, oh, you must read this person, I'm likely to say, it's probably not worth my time. Or maybe I'll check it out, but give it, you know, a cursory glance rather than actually digging into it, like I would with, say, William James, who is worth reading, right? So faith in other people's faith. This is a very interesting idea. He also talks about the faith in truth itself. He says, our belief in truth itself, that there is a truth and that our minds in it are made for each other. What is this but a passionate affirmation of desire in which our social system backs us up? We want to have a truth. We want to believe our experiments and studies and discussions must put us in a continually better and better position towards it. And on this line, we agree to fight out our thinking lives. But if a Pyrrhonist skeptic asks us how we can know all this, can our logic find a reply? James says, no. It's just one volition against another. We are willing to go in for a life upon a trust or assumption which he, for his part, does not care to make. And he points out here that we often disbelieve in facts and theories. Now, notice he doesn't just say theories or explanations or interpretations. We often disbelieve in facts, things that are staring us in the face that we have no use for. And he gives, as an example of this, three different religious orientations. William Clifford's cosmic emotions find no use for Christian feelings. Huxley belabors the bishops because there's no use for sacerdotalism in his scheme of life. But John Henry Newman, on the other hand, goes over to Romanism, that is Catholicism, and finds all sorts of reasons good for staying there because the priestly system is for him an organic need and delight. So you might say, oh, that's religious people. Then James targets the scientists and he says, why do so few scientists even look at the evidence for telepathy, so-called, sort of reading of minds or communication at a distance? He says, because they think, as a leading biologist, one, now dead, once said to me, even if such a thing were true, scientists ought to band together to keep it suppressed and concealed. It would undo the uniformity of nature and all sorts of things without which scientists cannot carry on their pursuits. But, James says, if this very man had been shown something which as a scientist he might do with telepathy, he might not only have examined the evidence, but found it good enough. And then James globalizes this. This very law which the logicians would impose upon us is based on nothing but their own natural wish to exclude all elements from which they and their professional quality as logicians can find no use. So what he's saying here is that dig deep enough and you'll find that pretty much every commitment of belief, whatever window dressing, or ever not just window dressing, but whatever deep apparatus of reason and argument and evidence and logic we bring to bear, willing nature is always driving it. Willing nature is always there. Willing nature is always involved. So we come again to the conclusion that he draws. Our passional nature not only lawfully may, but must decide an option between propositions whenever it is a genuine option that cannot by its nature be decided on intellectual grounds. Now notice what this is saying. If it can be decided on intellectual grounds, don't decide it on the basis of our willing nature. So don't be sloppy, don't be lazy, don't simply substitute feeling for fact, as we might say, right? But when it comes down to things where there is going to be disagreement and controversy, it's okay to bring in our passional nature. Not only is it okay, in some cases, we must decide on that very basis. So he says, to say under such circumstances, do not decide, but leave the question open, that itself is a passional decision, just like deciding yes or no, and it's attended with the same risk of losing the truth. So this is where the not just may, but must comes in. There are going to be some issues, some questions, on which during the course of our lives, we do have to declare ourselves, or we can decide not to, but that's also a declaration of some sort. And all of this is going to involve and be based on, to some extent, our willing or passionate nature. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.